Tried for a moment to imagine yourselves back in Jerusalem. The year is about 190 before the Common Era. You've been the headmaster of a fine, well thought of private school for the young sons of privileged families for the better part of your professional lifetime. And now, as your career begins to draw to a close, you've decided that it's time to collect together the wisdom, the insights, the maxims which you've used over and over again with your young charges, so that they and their sons' sons will in time have benefit of all that you've learned and all that you've tried to teach. And then you make the decision that you would like to end this collection of wise sayings with a series of thumbnail sketches of the great heroes of Israel's past. You'd like to present to the young people a series of role models. I doubt that you knew the word, but that's what you had in mind. And so you think back over the narratives of the Torah, and you begin to collect the names of those whose lives can provide a model for such as your young charges. Now, whom would you choose? Well, we know whom Ben Sirach chose. See how many of these choices are the same as yours. Noah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, but not Joseph, interestingly. Apparently, the self-centeredness and the egotism of the young Joseph, when he managed to turn his whole family against him because he thought he was privileged and special. Obviously, Ben Sirach didn't think that this was the kind of model he wanted to set for his young people. And then, of course, Moses and Aaron and Joshua. Well, how'd you do? But there's one name in this list, and only one that I haven't mentioned, that I suspect none of you thought of. Perhaps you don't even know this man exists in the Bible. His name is Phinehas. Did any of you think of Phinehas? As a matter of fact, Phinehas has one of the longer of the thumbnail biographies in the wisdom of Ben Sirach or Ecclesiasticus. And what is he praised for? He's praised for his extreme zeal in behalf of the Lord. Now, if you are a biblical scholar and you remember not the Bible that was taught to you by your Sunday school teachers, you know, all the nice, uplifting, sweet passages, but you've read it seriously, and you've read through what is perhaps the dullest of the five books of Moses, the book of Numbers, and you've paid attention, you've come across Phinehas. He turns out to be a grandson of Aaron, whose major accomplishment has to do with the fact that he is the exemplar for biblical man of militant zeal, the kind of person who is totally committed. The individual who cannot see the grays in life, to whom things are black and white, and once you're committed to the white, there's no other course. You remember that the tribes of Israel after the Exodus come within 3 months to Mount Sinai, linger there, receive the law. They then, within the first year, go to an area just south of the Holy Land at Kadesh Barnea. There's the attempt to, God tells them to go and conquer the land. They send out the spies. They're afraid. They refuse. And then they are consigned to a long, rather pointless year, 39 years of wandering in the wilderness. And much of this wandering time, this pointless trek, was spent in an area which was largely inhabited by the Moabites. And the Moabites apparently had very comely women who were also compliant. And a number of illicit liaisons were established between Moabite women and Israelite men. The Bible puts it very bluntly. And the Israelites went whoring after the Moabite women. And not only were these illicit relationships established, but according to the Bible, the Moabite women induced their men, their Israelite men, to join them in the worship of their god, who's known as Baal Peor. And our god becomes fiercely angry. And according to the Bible, he orders the killing of all those who have participated in idolatry and in these illicit relationships. And then we see the leaders Moses, Aaron, and others hesitating to carry out this fierce demand. But Phinehas does not hesitate. He goes and picks up a spear and follows one of the Israelite men into his tent, and he goes in after him, and he strikes down the man, and he strikes down his paramour. And for this, God, interestingly, according to this particular text, blesses Phinehas with the promise of the everlasting priesthood, that all the priests of Israel will descend from this man who is so militantly and violently committed. Now, this kind of commitments sends shivers up most of our spines. It's certainly the kind of text that you rarely hear from a contemporary pulpit as one that sets as an example for you of the kind of commitment which we are to involve ourselves in. But if you look through Jewish history, you'll find that again and again, Phinehas is treated as a hero, his militant zeal is praised. If you read, for instance, the story of Hanukkah as told in the book of Maccabees, you'll find that when Mattathias rallies around him the guerrillas who will fight against the Syrian Greeks, he uses Phinehas as his exemplar. He was willing to put his life on the line for the law, to strike with the sword for the basis of for the true worship of God. And then, 2 centuries later, Phinehas played another role as exemplar in one of the most unfortunate incidents in all of our Jewish history, perhaps the most unfortunate of all. In the early part of the first century, you remember that Augustus secures the Roman Empire. And Rome is a well-organized and carefully conceived state, which begins to transform the provinces into colonies, much the way 18th and 19th century European states did with what we call today the Third World, and to change their economies in such a way that they would produce the raw materials and the minerals and the wealth which would be of benefit to the capital. Judea was increasingly misruled. Judea was increasingly taxed heavily. It was an unhappy time. There were increasing pressures by the government, which brooked no kind of criticism of its activities. And there developed, of course, under these pressures, complaints, anger, frustration. This was also a time, this first century of the Common Era, when throughout the Middle East there was a common idea that the triumph of Rome really represented the last stage of this particular cycle of world history. The idea was current in many cultures that there were five millennia, five 1,000-year periods, the paradisial age, the golden age, which was the first century, and then a succeeding 1,000-year period, each one worse than the one before, culminating in an age of iron, the iron boot of Rome, and that age would culminate in the end of the world, end time, Armageddon, the day of judgment. There were many names for that culmination. And so there was a sense of messianic hope brought about by the very defeats and pressures of the time. And in fact, this is a time in which a number of messianic pretenders appear in West Asia. Jesus is only the best known of them. It was also a time, these early decades of the first century, when there developed in Israel men who took literally the concept which is in our Bible that we are to be the servants of the Lord our God. We are to be God's servants and the servants of none other. Israel had in the second century before the Common Era an experience of sovereignty, of independence, of freedom under the descendants of the Maccabees, the Hasmoneans. And then Rome had slowly imposed its will, first through puppet states, puppet governors, and then directly through its procurators. And now the time had come, these people argued, because it was end time, because we must purify ourselves before the coming of the Messiah. It was thus time to strike out against all who would rule us and misrule us. Israel must serve God and God alone. And the party who claimed this philosophy were called in Josephus the Zealots. And among the Zealots, there developed groups, we would call them today cells of people, who were simply terrorists. They're called the Sicarii. The Sicarii is a Latin name for a small, curved, bow-shaped, sharp knife, which these men carried underneath their cloaks. And in Jerusalem, on the great pilgrimage festival days, they would go about the street, hiding this weapon of theirs, and they would strike down those who were leaders in the community, whom they felt were cooperating with the Roman authorities. And they also went about creating incidents with the Roman soldiers. They would throw rocks to make sure that there would be an act of repression. Modern terrorists would call this propaganda by the deed. They would call it consciousness raising. They would call it the striking down of the devil, of the enemy, of the state. But these Jews, these Sicarii, these cells of zealots, went about attacking other Jews primarily, and increasingly making it impossible, both psychologically and in terms of policy, for those who recognized the futility of a rebellion against the great might of Rome from expressing themselves, from holding sway. Because sweet reason rarely is a potent weapon against those who actually wield the weapons. And finally, in the sixth decade of the first century, they had their way. The rebellion came, and the rebellion was an unmitigated disaster. 1 million Jews were killed. Jerusalem was razed. The temple was destroyed. Judaism, which represented probably 20% of the population of the Eastern Roman Empire, Judaism, which had been an expanding tradition, which had not only a solid core of faith, but which had found ways to approach all classes within the Roman community, suddenly was labeled the enemy, subversive, something to be avoided. And like a great volcanic eruption, there are always aftershocks. And there are two aftershocks of this great rebellion against Rome. One in 115, 117, when the diaspora, particularly the Libyan Egyptian diaspora, rose in rebellion and was really utterly destroyed. And then the Bar Kokhba rebellion of 132 and 135, another 1 million Judeans killed. From a tradition which had had an opportunity to truly fulfill God's hope that out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem, that there would be the expansion of the tradition and of the traditional ways around the world. Suddenly, Judaism was relegated to a minority status, a defensive status. The tradition had to turn inward. We had to have an iron discipline, what we call rabbinic Judaism, emerges. And though there are greatness in this new tradition, we were ever after consigned to a politically relatively impotent future. The long histories of medieval suffering are, in a sense, foreshadowed. Terrorism, Jewish terrorism, bred Jewish disaster, both in terms of the lives that were lost then and of the whole direction of Jewish history, which was forever changed by this rebellion precipitated by the terrorists. Now, I begin in this way because in recent years, Israel and Jews have so often been the object of terrorist attack. And many of us have begun to think of terrorism as something directed against us, their problem. We're simply the victims. But in point of fact, terrorism represents something which is almost elemental in the social order. There are always people like Phineas who are willing to strike for the truth, their gods, their God, their ideology. You see things in black and white and have no compunction, no basic sensitivity, compassion, because their passion overwhelms their compassion. And there are always those who simply rejoice in adventure, the daredevils, who love to live with the sword, love to put their lives on the line. That gives them their high, their thrill, their sense of fulfillment. And there are always those who want a sense of power, who feel their impotence, but who in one act, by striking down a Kennedy, by striking down a Martin Luther King, by striking down a Mahatma Gandhi, can suddenly affect, in a basic way, the whole course of human history. Their lives suddenly become significant. They believe through the sword. And the media, of course, encouraged them in that belief. And so it is that whatever society one looks at over the course of history, there have always been those who have been willing to take to the sword in order to correct what they perceive to be wrongs or to sponsor a cause, whatever that cause may be. There have always been those who have seen this world in this Manichaean way, black, white. The white must be served, whatever the cost. Now, of course, the sponsorship of Phinian kind of zeal is not the only approach the Bible takes to commitment. The Bible warns us also, do not be righteous over much. And there's another example besides Phinehas's in the Torah, Moses's. Remember that when the tribes are at Mount Sinai, when Moses goes up to the mountain to receive the law, the tribes feel that their God and their leader has deserted them, and they begin to build a golden calf and to dance and to worship before the calf. And God, of course, is livid in his anger. And when they hear of the golden calf and Moses comes down the mountain, he tells Moses, destroy this people and I will raise out of your own seed a new nation. But instead of picking up the sword and beginning the slaughter, Moses intercedes with God. Have patience, forgive, be understanding. There must be some sensitivity to the rights, to the needs, to the failings of other human beings. Now, terrorism itself is a complex and difficult phenomenon to understand. And around terrorism, of course, there's a great deal of romanticism which flourishes. Many believe that the terrorist would not act as he or she does were it not for insufferable, insupportable oppression. That it is the oppression which leads to the violence. And therefore, there's a certain dignity, a certain rightness to what the terrorist does because they're reacting in the only way they know how, to evil. Interestingly, if you want to be a social scientist, one of the things that you learn very quickly is that one of the signs of the weakening of a dictatorship, of a tyranny, one of the signs that the tyranny is beginning to open up, that they're beginning to be more tolerant of criticism, that they're beginning to permit change, is the development of terrorism, the appearance of terrorism in that community. There is no terrorism in the Soviet Union. There is no terrorism in Czechoslovakia, or Hungary, or Bulgaria, or Lithuania. There is oppression. A modern tyranny, a modern oligarchy, can efficiently suppress terrorism. Where is there terrorism? There's terrorism in Northern Ireland, where the British are unwilling or unable to impose an iron law, an iron fist on the land. And where the terrorist, when he is caught, or she is caught, they're mostly male in Ireland, when the terrorist is caught, knows that the worst he faces is a jail sentence until some Englishman is kidnapped and then he's traded and his freedom is given. Where is there terrorism in the modern world? There is terrorism where it is state-supported, as in the Middle East, where the terrorist has the backing of actual governments. There's terrorism in those countries where there is a great deal of freedom and of opportunity. The Baader-Meinhof gang, which terrorized Western Europe, particularly West Germany, in the late 60s and early 70s, operated in an area where there is democracy. There's an opportunity at the polls, there's an opportunity in many, many ways to right whatever the wrongs may be. And the wrongs themselves are not always wrongs. There are all kinds of so-called causes. I suspect there are very few in this room who would argue that the violence and terrorism, the Ku Klux Klan in the 30s was nobly motivated, or that of their modern clone, the Order, in the 1980s. Or what about the German Freikorps, which during the years of the Weimar Republic was a neo-Nazi movement of kidnapping and assassination designed to undermine what was then the nascent democracy that was Germany. Terrorism is not necessarily a response to what most people would call intolerable evil. You remember the Sibyanese Liberation Army? What was their cause? What did Pat Hearst have as a cause? Nothing. And many of these groups are simply nihilistic. They come out of an anarchistic tradition whose whole purpose is simply to undermine, to kill, to create and sow confusion. Now, increasingly in modern times, anarchism and terrorism has taken on new forms. The connection between cause and act, between cause and terrorist, has become increasingly uncertain. You remember the attack on the Lod Airport in the early 1970s? Three men got off a plane and began machine gunning in the airport itself. Were they Palestinians? Were they Arabs? Not at all. They were Japanese. All of the members of the so-called Japanese Red Brigade, who had simply been paid by the Fatah to carry out this massacre. And when last Yom Kippur, three Jews who really should have been in shul were on a yacht in Locarno Harbor in Cyprus and were held captive, then assassinated by the PLO, who were the three PLO soldiers? Two of them were Arabs, neither of them Palestinians, by the way, and the third was an Englishman who had simply hired himself out for money, for adventure, who knows for what reasons, to the PLO. Perhaps he simply didn't like Jews. Increasingly in our world, there is an underworld of terrorists who have banded together across national lines, across lines of interest, for what we would call simply criminal purposes. The Bader-Meinhof gang trained its soldiers in PLO military camps in the Lebanon in the 1960s. And those who trained them in these camps had themselves been trained in commando camps in the Soviet Union in the 1950s. The arms which were used by the Bader-Meinhof gang in holding up banks and kidnapping German industrialists and shooting German jurists were smuggled to them in diplomatic pouches by Algerian and Libyan diplomats. Now, where is the cause? The so-called holy cause, intolerable oppression in all of this. What we have, in fact, is the existence in our world and any world of groups of people who are impatient, who believe that somehow the gun, the sword, the rockets in their hands give them a sense of power, will allow them to shake the world, and who are unwilling to be patient or to trust the development of their cause or their need to other more political processes. The ultimate model of the terrorist were the members of Narodnaya Volnya, the group in Tsarist Russia in the 1870s, a group of perhaps 200, 300 young people who bound together into cells of a group called the Freedom Brigade, who began a process of assassination of the leaders of the Tsarist police, the Department of Interior, ultimately assassinated the Tsar himself. Now, most of these young people, many of them, were children of the most established families in the Soviet Union, titled families, noble families, wealthy families. And there was a certain nobility to what they did in the sense that there was serfdom, there was censorship, there was oppression, there was venality in the Tsarist Russia of their day. and they were taking their lives in their hands. If they were caught, they were tortured and hung. And many of them had still had scruples about killing anybody but the person they had designated as a murderer, as a venal and a corrupt person. There's a story of one of the young noblemen who had access to the Winter Palace, who was sent in to assassinate the man who was the head of the Department of Interior, which controlled the secret police. And he got into the palace and he had his dynamite with him, but the man who he was sent to assassinate came out with his wife and his child, and he refused to throw the dynamite. He did so 3 weeks later when he found the man alone. Now that kind of scruple gave a certain dignity to the work of these Narodnaya Volnya, and they got it, and because there were obvious legitimacy in the minds of many to some of their complaints, there was a certain amount of instinctive support for their activities. Not always. If you want to read the other side of the story, read Dostoevsky's The Possessed, where you have an image of the terrorist as simply a man who is possessed by zeal, possessed by the need for blood, who has very little thought, really, to the cause he supposedly supports. But the men and women of the Narodnaya Volnya, these young assassins of the 18th, these people with a cause, there was a clear cause. They stayed in Russia. They put their lives on the line. And there was a certain obvious support, instinctive support, for what they did. But unfortunately, in all terrorist activity, there are two sides to what the terrorist must do. The terrorist has the person whom they want to attack, has the government that they want to overthrow, or the political party that they want to subvert, and they also must survive. And so one major element, and often the major element in terrorist activity, is that which brings in the gold, brings in the money. The Narodnaya Volnya attacked banks. They attacked the mail trains in the Soviet Tsarist Russia in order to get the support that they needed to continue their work. Today, there are still the assassinations. There are still the kidnappings. It's estimated that the terrorists of Latin and South America earn something on the order of $40 million a year from kidnapping American businessmen, American and European businessmen. And then there is, of course, the most efficient economic source of all, that is direct support from nation states. The Palestine Liberation Organization, it is reported, has an annual income of $500 million. Where do they get their income? From direct state subventions, from Saudi Arabia, from Kuwait, from the Gulf states, ultimately from the gas that we buy at the pumps to keep our cars going. Now, once you have $500 million, there's very little that you cannot buy in way of sophisticated arms. Once you have governmental support, there are always places where you can have a quasi-political base. You can have your barracks. You can keep, as the PLO does, 15,000 men under arms at all times. You can organize the most extravagant kinds of political activity, propaganda by deed. The problem is that you can't always translate all of this, as the PLO has not been able to translate its murder, its hijackings of planes, its Black September attack on the athletes at Munich. You cannot necessarily translate that into the success of that which you claim to be your cause. The PLO has not been able to do, and very few organizations have been able to accomplish that, whatever their degree of support. But those who study terrorism today remark on the fact, often, that terrorism has become part of a quasi-political underworld, which is becoming increasingly important in the whole operation of world policy. Start with the fact that nuclear war is unthinkable. Start with the assumption that people are actually deterred by the idea of nuclear deterrence. So this vast outpouring of weaponry, of money into weapons, highly sophisticated weapons, are simply an outpouring of money into weapons which are never used. And power which is never used is really no power. Now, what's the next step? The great massed armies of the United States, NATO, the Warsaw Pact, of the Soviet Union, of China. These armies rarely go into the field. Why so? Because the great powers are scared, are convinced that if there are positional armies in the field fighting positional wars like the Second World War, the First World War, these wars will quickly escalate into nuclear confrontations. There are tactical nuclear weapons in the hands of these armies today. And so the argument is that standing armies also are impotent. They're there, but you can't use them. What can you use? You use advisors. You use those shadowy figures whom we sometimes send down into Nicaragua. You use the Eastern Europeans and the Cubans whom the Russians regularly send into Africa, to Angola, to Ethiopia. You use surrogates. And increasingly, the terrorist groups of the world are part and parcel of this whole third level of military action. This is not positional war any longer, but it's war fought to subvert a given set of states, or governments, so that the natural resources or the military bases or the human resource of that particular country becomes more sympathetic to, more useful to this power rather than that set of powers. And increasingly, the terrorist groups of the world have been used by other groups for their own purposes. 2 weeks ago, we read of the attack on the Supreme Court of Colombia by a group known as M19, a group of terrorists who've been fighting against the Colombian government for the better part of 15 years. Now, why did they attack the Supreme Court building? From what I've been able to read and ascertain, the answer has to do not at all with the political overthrow of Betancourt's government, but it has to do rather with America's attempt to staunch the flow of drugs into the United States. The United States was able to arrange a treaty with Colombia by which the Colombian government said that they would extradite the drug lords to the United States to stand for criminal trial. And the great drug lords of Colombia, who are a quasi-feudal force in major parts of the country, simply hired the M19, the terrorist group, to attack the courts which were rendering a series of decisions legitimizing this treaty, and particularly to go after those judges who had in a number of cases recently sent major Colombian drug figures to jail. Now here we have terrorism 1980 style. The takeover by a group of terrorists who supposedly have noble causes to take over on behalf of drug lords who supply them with their money and with their guns, the takeover of a government or of a major part, an institution of the government, to undermine its ability to do something which is obviously good for the world. It goes deeper. The planes that brought drugs from Colombia to the Caribbean and to the United States brought back from Cuba the arsenal which was used by groups like the M19 to continue the guns to continue their activity. And so whether we look at the Fatah, the PLO, we look at some of the terrorist groups in Latin America, we look at terrorist groups in Cambodia, the Pot Pol, who once they took over the government killed 2 million of their own people. Much of the mystique, the romantic mystique which surrounds terrorism in the 20th century begins to be stripped away. We Americans are a wonderfully romantic people. I wouldn't have it any other way. We tend to assume that where there's anger, there's a legitimate cause. We tend to assume that human beings act rationally and reasonably. And so when there's violence, we think of undoing the causes of the violence. Why is there violence in the center city of our communities? There's violence in the center city of our communities because there's poverty, there's illiteracy, there's all those elements which make for social disadvantage, frustration. And that's all true. But it's also true that there are people in the center city who are not violent, not moved to violence. It's also true that there is something in the human breast which, under the right set of circumstances, explodes into violence. Violence is not limited to those in the center city. Violence can occur in your neighborhood, in mine, and not simply brought there by those who live in the city. Human nature is a complex phenomenon. In human nature includes the saint who withdraws lest he be contaminated by the world, and the Phineas, the man of militant zeal, who tries to destroy in order to purify the world. Terrorism is with us, and terrorism is a frightening phenomenon. How shall we respond to it? The Soviets have the best response. Never give it a chance. Nip it in the bud. If you find somebody with a knife on the street, he disappears into Siberia and he's never heard of ever since. The Gulag. But obviously, we don't want to turn our society into a mirror image of theirs. The Israelis do the best they can. Their philosophy is to protect themselves at all costs and to revenge themselves, that is, to make the terrorist pay for the terror itself. And so when three Israelis are killed by a group from the Fatah headquarters in Tunis, in Cyprus, the Israeli planes raid that headquarters and destroy it. It doesn't end the terrorism, but it does, to a certain degree, limit it. And Israel is too small a state to do much more. The United States has taken a number of steps, which we're all too familiar, which are trying to protect ourselves against terrorism. When we go to an airplane, our baggage is examined, we are put through an X-ray machine. When you go into a public building, a woman with a purse must open her purse to show that there's no gun inside. Increasingly, we're protecting any number of government officials with layers of Secret Service type of people to protect them from assassination or kidnapping. Increasingly, corporate leaders are hiring various kinds of bodyguard agencies to protect them from violence. Security has become a major industry in this country. But so far, despite the big talk, we've had very little by way of being able to respond effectively to the terrorist because we are caught by our own sense of what's proper and what's right. In the United States, a person is innocent until they're proved guilty. To be proved guilty, the crime must already have taken place. Someone must have been hurt. Now, if we wait for the crime to take place, that is, for terrorism to have its way, the act must already have happened. And given the glare of the television cameras, that act will be well publicized. It will be, in that sense, effective. Something will have been said to the world. And beyond that, people will have been killed or hurt. Now, what about what about punishment for those who perform these attacks? The punishment of the terrorist is almost impossible in our modern world. Terrorism is a very comfortable bourgeois activity. How long do you think the four Arabs who shipjacked, if there is such a word, the Achille Lauro 3 weeks ago will remain in Italian jails? They murdered, they took over a ship, they terrorized, but how long will they remain in jail? For the truth is, but given the sponsorship of modern terrorist organizations, it is almost impossible for any free society to keep terrorists in jail for any length of time, because as long as there are terrorists in their jails, their citizens around the world are at risk. What's the issue in the Lebanon today? Why does the Archbishop of Canterbury's representative, why is he there? What are the demands of these Islamic fundamentalists, as they're called, to free people who are, after all, there because they're ultimately sympathetic with the Arab cause? All of these people, and they're holding, are their real friends. Why are they holding them? They're holding them because 17 of their colleagues are in jail in Kuwait for having tried to assassinate the leadership of Kuwait. And what do you read in our papers? What doesn't matter if 17 murderers are let loose, more murderers are let loose in the Arab world? There's so many there anyway. Let's get our people home. And they'll get home. And the murderers will be let go. The American government's position is, if we can define who the murderer is, we'll go after him. We said that very bravely after the TWA hijacking this summer. I was amused 2 days ago. I was watching the news, and this tall 6'4" Englishman who's a pro-Arab, who's used for that reason because he has contacts with Arab radicals, was being escorted into the airport in Beirut. And the commentator said, you know, I recognize here two of the men who skyjacked the American plane. There they are in the greeting committee for this movement to release the European and American hostages. That's how severely the terrorist is punished. Why was Abdul Abbas let go by the Italian government? It was not because of the nicety that he was on an Egyptian plane and that he had diplomatic status. They couldn't wait the 20 minutes to receive the proof that he had masterminded the taking over the Kilauea. They were scared stiff that if they had him in one of their jails, none of their consulates, none of their embassies, none of their diplomats, none of their citizens would be safe, and many of their economic arrangements, beneficial economic arrangements in the Arab world would be at risk. And that's why, unlike the Russian Narodnaya Volnya youngsters of the 1870s, whose lives were on the line, most of them end up being hung or shot, terrorism is today a very safe activity. And I call it bourgeois, and I mean that. It's a very profitable activity. Most of the leaders of these terrorist groups have bank accounts in Switzerland. I don't, but they do. And they're the ones who claim to be speaking for the poor, the downtrodden, the oppressed, the refugees of the world. It's good business, if you can stand that kind of business. Terrorism is not a noble undertaking, which is not to say that many of the terrorists have not had causes which themselves have a certain compelling quality to them. But it's interesting that the world selects certain causes to think about and not others. I've often thought of the poor Kurds, whom, in terms of several million people, have lived now for centuries in that area between Iraq, Iran, and Turkey. The Kurds have been struggling for independence for the last 50 years. Has the world rallied to their cause? They're slaughtered from time to time by the Iranians, they're slaughtered from time to time by the Iraqis, the Turks slaughtered them about 50 years ago, and the world doesn't listen, doesn't care. What about the South Moluccan people who want independence, the Bengalis? You ever thought of them? Their needs are just as great as the Palestinians. But somehow there are certain causes which the world selects for reasons which have nothing to do with the cause itself, but with the power of the group behind it, or the economic advantage of trading with that group, and other groups whose needs simply disappear, are never discussed. Terrorism, above all else, seeks publicity. And one of the reasons that terrorism has become such a problem in our day is the television. Terrorists will skyjack a plane, and there'll be 100 television cameras at every airport in the Mediterranean, waiting to see where that plane will land, following out all each one of the details of the activity. And what happens? All kinds of conversation takes place. Demands are made by the terrorists who claim their cause. Suddenly, it becomes imperative for the world to solve the Israeli-Palestinian problem. It's an insoluble problem, but it has to be solved because terrorists have taken hostages. And the world wants not to think about violence, not to think about what has led, what really leads to all of this. And so the TV cameras grind on, the issue is held up. Terrorism today requires really a mastermind dramatist to stage, to be the leader of the group, because you have to go from one activity to another. When terrorism becomes repetitive, stenciled, it loses its TV appeal. Remember when all those planes about every week were going in, oh, 8, 9 years ago from Miami to Cuba or Cuba to Miami? We watched the first and the second. We hardly noticed the third. 60 of them were hijacked. But we lost interest. And therefore, the hijackings really stopped. Why was a ship taken? Because they'd run the question of skyjacking for a while into the ground. They had to find something which was a little more dramatic to cause attention to their cause. And once they have called attention to their cause in every way they know, they assume, they hope, that this will create frustration, anger, urgency, and help them achieve their ends. It rarely does. For the sad truth is that when you look at violent causes around the world, they lead not to freedom, but to greater suppression. Do you remember the Tupamaros? The Tupamaros appeared in the early 1960s in Uruguay. Again, young. Most terrorists tend to start young if they start with a cause. Young, upper class, upper middle class, university educated. Uruguay happened to be, at the time, the longest live, most stable democracy in South America. Uruguay also, unfortunately, at the time, was going through an economic recession. And there were problems. There was unemployment. There were problems. And so the Tupamaros appear on this scene, and they begin to attack venality. They begin to attack the oppressive sides of the government. Every government is oppressive to a certain sense. Assassinations take place, kidnappings take place. And what happens? The army takes it up to a point, and then they undertake a campaign of repression. And at the end of the Tupamaro experience, they were either hunted down or they fled in exile. Uruguay emerges as a military dictatorship. Whatever freedom there has been lost. The cause is frustrated. The average Uruguayan is less well off than he was or she was before. Have they achieved a goal, their end? I doubt it.